Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cheese and Pickle.
Hello, this is Comfort Blanket and I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to someone who makes cool stuff that I like about some warm stuff that they like. A book or a TV show or a film or a record they go back to again and again for comfort. This time I'm talking to the actor and writer Jim Howick. Jim is a familiar face to a whole generation from his work with Horrible Histories and is now providing one of television's most important current comfort blankets in the form of Ghosts, which he writes and stars in as Pat the Scoutmaster. Jim also did things like Yonderland and the film Bill and appears in other people's work. He's recently been in Bridget Christie's The Change. He's in loads of stuff and he's lovely, and he has chosen for his comfort blanket the film With Nail and Eye.
Londoners have to wake up to this. And murder, and O'Brien, and rape. And I'm sitting in this bloody shack and I can't cope with Withnor. I must be out of my mind. I must go home at once and discuss his problems in depth.
Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me.
Have you brought something lovely for us to look at?
I have, indeed. I would like us to look at With Nail and Eye.
With Nail and Eye. Fantastic idea. I can't believe no one's done it yet.
I can't believe it. We've had so many of my favourites pass by, and I couldn't believe it when you told me that this hadn't been done before.
Not been claimed, but definitely a comfort film, a film people watch again and again and again, and probably watch in their heads between watches. It's running in your head in the background if you're a fan, isn't it?
It is. It's constantly there. It's so universally loved. I'm so pleased to be able to plant my flag in it, the Howick crest.
You claim this now. This is yours.
Which would be, I don't know what that would be, maybe a martini and in the background maybe a rotisserie chicken. Or
get the College of Heralds to run that up. That's perfect.
We've just run out of wine. What are we going to do about it?
I don't know. Oh, God. I don't feel good. My thumbs have gone weird.
So when did you first see, is this a student film? Because it is for a lot of people.
Totally. So when I first saw this film, I was 18 and I just moved from my hometown of Bognor Regis to Wood Green, which in the 90s was still quite a troubled area. And I was sharing a studio flat with a fellow drama student. He introduced it to me because he's got sort of older, cooler sisters. My sister's cool, but his sisters were goths and stuff, so, you know.
Right, cool. Yes.
A bit more alternative.
In the hierarchy of sisters.
Yes.
I feel unusual. I think we should go outside.
It was like a 4D experience. There was cheap wine, there was sort of a bit of hash. And I was completely blown away by the sort of sense of romance, I think.
Right.
We can't go on like this. I'm a trained actor reduced to the status of a bum.
Because it romanticises that extremely grubby lifestyle.
Yeah. It's a kamikaze lifestyle. It's a boozy, self-destructive, romantic lifestyle that I was, fair to say, indulging in and certainly looking forward, because I actually watched it before I even started the course.
Right.
So I was just going down to sort of for the first week. Our course was delayed and we didn't start until October. So for the first couple of weeks, I was just sort of milling around Camden, where it's set.
September. It's a bad patch.
I was totally living that lifestyle to an extent, obviously not quite as extreme.
Yeah.
I wasn't drinking lighter fluid. But it was Lambrini.
Yeah, so it was sort of the same.
Yeah.
The same stuff.
Even the wankers on the site wouldn't drink that. That's worse than meth.
Nonsense. This is a far superior drink to meths. The wankers don't drink it because they can't afford it.
For a lot of people, what it puts on screen is a version of your life that you kind of aspire to and are frightened of at the same time.
I must have some booze. I demand to have some booze!
It felt like, when I first watched it, that they were a bit older than me. Again, I was a student, and they graduated. And it had that feeling that you got when you watched Grange Hill. You know, oh, is this what life's going to be like? Is this what the older kids are doing?
Yeah.
It was a bigger kids movie going, is that what's to come for me?
Totally.
And obviously, in all its glory, and all its wit and debauch and swagger, but also in its filth and desperation and misery.
Totally that. It was a film about growing up. And actually, within those, whatever it is, an hour and 43 minutes, you have, certainly the first act, it feels like a survival movie. And I'm a sucker for a survival movie. I love a survival movie. You know, Arctic, with Mads Mikkelsen, very fine actor. It's in Camden.
We've got an embrocation. To rub on us, you fool. We can cover ourselves in deep heat and get up against the radiator. Keep ourselves alive till 12.
I loved The Revenant. Lots of people didn't. Yeah. I loved it. In fact, first time I saw The Revenant, I was so hungover that the moment where he sort of climbs into the dead carcass of the horse, I was actually really jealous because it looked really sort of comfortable.
I wish
I was inside a dead horse instead of Enfield Cineworld.
And why has my head gone numb?
Yeah, I love a survival movie. And it feels like that. The idea that they go to the pub and have this crazy itinerary. We're going to get into the pub at opening time. We're going to get wrecked. Then we're going to eat a pork pie.
All right, this is the plan. We'll get in there and get wrecked. Then we'll eat a pork pie.
I mean, that is my sort of plan, even now.
And we'll drop a couple of 7s or 50s each. It means we'll miss out Monday, but come up smiling Tuesday morning.
First time I watched it, I didn't know what it was going to be. It's very hard to remember what it felt like to watch With Nan and I without knowing With Nan and I.
You are cordially invited to spend a carefree weekend in the English countryside.
And once you do know the stakes and the world and the language of it and what's going on, then it becomes really comforting because you know what's coming. The first time around I watched it, I think until they got the chicken, they're trying to kill the chicken, I didn't understand what the hell was going on. I thought, what are they after? Where are they going? No one's told me what they're after. Watching it again this time around for this, probably first time in 15 years, I thought, it's really clear. They say what they want, but they talk about it as if it's a military mission.
Yes.
All right, we're going to have to work quickly. A pair of quadruple whiskies and another pair of pints, please.
They talk about it as if it is survival. They over-dramatise their lives.
Totally, yes.
And I hadn't noticed how funny it was that these drama students, these actors who aren't allowed to act, are then making a drama out of their very banal lives.
Right, you fucker. I'm going to do the washing up.
No, you can't. It's impossible, I swear. I've looked into it. Listen to me.
And that is something it's got in common with Spaced.
Yes.
The idea that you're living in a film and that you're massively, massively overdramatic, and that's what's funny about it.
We'll see you at the rendezvous.
Okay, Tim.
Good luck.
It's this Shakespearean military survival language used for getting an egg sandwich or a pint.
Yeah, absolutely. To the minute.
You haven't slept in 60 hours. You're in no state to tackle it. Wait till the morning, we'll go in together.
This is the morning. Stand aside.
This is our mission, this is what we've got, this is our supplies.
It's the Beatles in America. Yeah. At 1806, you're out of the lift. At 1809, you're in the lift. It's that, but replaced with cider and gin and pork pie.
Two large gins, 2 pints of cider, ice in the cider.
And the way they talk about it is very funny. And you know how little they've got and how much they want. They say it out loud. And it's described, if you look it up in on any sort of movie site, as two out-of-work actors living in poverty. And then early on, Richard E. Grant waves a £10 note. And later on, they get a pair of blues. They get £10 of... I looked up, do you know how much that is? It's £140.
Pair of blues.
What's brilliant about Within Our Life is they're not in poverty. They're doing absolutely fine if they didn't spend all the money on booze.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me that what's joyous and comforting about this film is it's got the feel of poverty, but they've got wealth around them.
Just trying to establish you in some sort of context you'd understand.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, free to those that can afford it, very expensive to those that can't.
They're going to be fine. They're desperate, but also there's a sort of almost a P.G. Woodhouse level of, no matter how desperate this gets, they're of a class and access to money that they're sort of playing at this. Yes. So they're probably going to be okay. And your job as a viewer is to pretend it's as desperate as they think it is. And then you can laugh, because they're probably safe.
Totally.
Why don't you ask your father for some money? If we had some money, we could go away.
Why don't you ask your father? It's going to be so cold in here.
There's an awful lot of snobbery in the film. In fact, you know, the reality is that they're living a lie.
Yes.
When they visit Uncle Monty's house, and Uncle Monty inquires on how Withnail's career is going, he tells a load of porkies.
Yeah, he says he's very, very busy in film.
Very busy, and my agent's directing me towards RSC. You know, and we've just seen quite clearly that he's eaten a raw potato. That's the only food he's eaten, and he's got a sole flapping off his shoe, and he's 30 next month. So it's the idea of how long, because we don't know how fresh they are out of drama school in the film. We don't know that. So it's
they've got agents and things. So obviously they've done okay.
Yeah, but they're happy to sort of almost live in secret squalor.
Yes.
If my father was loaded, I'd ask him for some money.
Your father's my father, you wouldn't get it.
It's funny because it's a film that stayed with me through drama school, through different aspects, almost through different acts, actually.
I've got us a bottle open. Confiscated it from Monty's supplies. 53 Margot, best of the century.
So when the film's over and he's left alone, it very much reminds me still of the time when our student house broke up because one of our flatmates got a job in touring Miss Saigon and another one went on tour in Italy and so we had to all say goodbye.
Yeah.
And that is when life became terrifying.
You got the part, man. I got a different one. They want me to play the lead. Congratulations.
Being an actor in your 20s is terrifying.
You're thrown out into the real world and it's extremely insecure.
Very.
Four floors up on the Charing Cross Road and never a job at the top of them.
Financially and also from pride point of view, you have an awful lot of people telling you, certainly if you come from a working class background, you have an awful lot of people telling you that it beats a proper job.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when it doesn't work out, certainly for the first few years, it does cross your mind, how am I going to sort of sell this? How am I going to sort of pretend that I'm happier than I am?
Rather busy, Uncle. TV and stuff. My agent's attempting to edge me towards the Royal Shakespeare Company again.
Oh, splendid.
You know, luckily, when I was 26, I started working regularly. But when I was working at Ticketmaster, for the second year that I was working at Ticketmaster, there were quite a few people, certainly back at home, who would sort of indicate maybe I should, you know, give it up.
Because it's a gamble.
It is.
I mean, any freelance job is a bit of a gamble. Any job in the arts is a gamble. And any job where there's as much rejection, you do the same amount of work for a job you don't get as a job you do get. And it's one of the things that people don't understand about the arts generally is that you might do really well out of a job, pay really well for doing that. But no, there were many, many days where you were working just as hard and the pay was zero.
I've already put 2 shilling pieces in. No, I haven't got another.
And when you look at how it breaks down over a year, you're probably, as people, authors are and actors are, you're probably making minimum wage if you're really lucky.
Why wouldn't they see me? This is ridiculous. I haven't been up for a job in 3 months.
They've come out of drama school. They're good. I'm going to be a star, he says. They're perfectly good actors. But that makes no difference to their earning potential, and they are living in a strange, numbed depression about the difference in their aspirations and the reality of their lives.
Understudy Constantine. I'm not going to understudy Constantine. Why can't I play the part?
And that's a very specific thing to your early days as a creative of any sort, a musician, an actor, a writer. You won't be able to pull the money in, and you're just gambling on one thing working out.
Yeah.
Listen, I pay you 10% to do that. Well, lick 10% of the arses for me then. Hello?
And then, I mean, that's the sort of disparity between the two characters in the respect that that scene at the phone box when Withnail is offered to understudy Constantine, the seagull, and he point blank refuses and hangs up on his agent, or his agent hangs up on him eventually. But it's
Marwood, isn't it?
Marwood. You would only know that if you read the script, I suppose, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's never referred to as Marwood.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he basically says, well, why not? Why not do it? Why not take the work? Take the money.
Apparently they're still seeing people.
You want to go to Manchester anyway. Play a bloody soldier.
Can't I? I don't know, dude.
But there's a pride issue, a huge pride issue. And this, I suppose, not delusionary, but certainly a sense of I should be better.
Bastards! You all suffer! I show the lot of you! I'm going to be a star!
Probably because he's from a privileged place, exactly. This character.
Exactly. That is the thing I hadn't spotted with this before. And I watched it thinking, I loved this film. And its sense of swagger and entitlement and wit and language and the languorousness of the world of Uncle Monty and Withnall, that they just swagger about. Money will come from somewhere. There's a very interesting class thing going on in Withnall, in that Withnall and Uncle Monty have a swagger, an entitlement that Marwood doesn't have. And Marwood, by all accounts, represents Bruce Robinson, the director and writer. There's a lovely thing, David Dundas, who's his old flatmate. And David Dundas is Lord David Dundas. He did the music for Withnall. He's the old flatmate of Bruce Robinson. He said the moment that Marwood looks out the window of the Jaguar and pulls his glasses down, flips down those shades, he looks so much like Bruce Robinson that Dundas thought it was Bruce Robinson. So he is representing the writer and director who lived this. Yeah. So I looked up Bruce Robinson and thought, where's his sense of entitlement come from? The swagger. And Bruce Robinson went to a secondary modern in Kent, and Kent's still got grammar schools, still has today. So if you're at a secondary modern in Kent, you've really not come from good stock. You're not even getting the advantages of being able to move socially. He is a complete outsider to this, like a lot of people are when they're the first person in their family to go to drama school. Bruce Robinson has the swagger of someone of enormous entitlement, but it's a 60s version of that where you could be Michael Caine and raise up and have a chance to leave your class. Bruce Robinson is a complete outsider. He's watching these posh, rich actors going, I want to be like them. And he affects their swagger, but he's a hard worker. Mm. And the thing about Marwood is Marwood will take the work.
It's a bloody good little theatre.
There's not much of a part there, is it?
Well, it's better than nothing.
They make you cut your hair off.
So what? You'd lose a leg.
Yeah, and it's a lovely study of that 60s shake-up of the class system that meant suddenly there's an access to these sort of slightly grand professions that more and more working-class kids are getting into. And Bruce Robinson, I never realised, and it changes the way you watch Withnall, is an outsider to that, and he's watching these posh, entitled people and wondering at them. And it depicts that moment of change really, really well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you write poems?
No, I wish I could. It's just thoughts, really.
Are you published?
No.
When they were welcome, I mean, you know, there was the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool and the Royal Court Productions, David Hare Productions. And
yeah.
So it felt like they were welcome in that world. What's interesting in the scene when they meet Monty for the first time, away from the vegetables and the Hamlet quotes and everything else, and the problematic homosexual lines and things, which actually still makes me wince. In any moment now, he's going to get into his tights, and not only that, he's a raving homosexual. That's the line.
Feels like it's set then. It's what would have been. It reads well, and also certainly Bruce Robinson said the way Dennis O'Brien and Hamlet wanted him depicted, which is a complete mincing queen.
Yes,
there's so much more dignity and humanity in the way that Uncle Monty is played by Richard Griffiths. He's definitely a real person who's really suffering and tortured.
It's true.
It's
yeah.
not. It's not. It's
absolutely.
Not quite
it's
as
more
outsider-ish
really
as it
from my sort of perspective. Watching a sort of beloved film. The same thing happens in The Big Lebowski. There's a couple of lines in that as well. But it's the moment where he asks Marwood where he schooled. Where did you
yes.
school? And Withnall isn't specific. He says he went to the other place.
Where did you school?
He went to the other place, Monty.
Went to Eton.
Which must mean Eton.
Yes.
Otherwise, anything else is completely incomprehensible to Monty.
They exist in a world where that is normal, where that brilliant way that anyone really posh, you met really, really posh people, they assume you are also really posh. It's a strangely generous thing.
It is.
But also
absolutely.
Born out of never having met anyone who isn't really posh.
Yes, absolutely. But it opens up the idea that there is a boundary to get past. The fact that they're whispering to each other in Latin.
Yeah.
An entirely new language, dead language.
It's their code.
Yes.
It does feel
their code, yeah.
And you feel the various different factions that existed in British culture at that time.
Yeah.
And the blurring of them that has been represented by hippiedom and everything being shaken up. And then Monty representing an older world, but a world in which he is not quite free to exist.
Yeah.
The 60s have come along and he's sort of stealing love and sort of half closeted and sort of half out, pretending that the boys who are coming out to Crow Crag are like his
son.
His son is the farmer. Yeah. He's up there with his son.
Yeah, oh, that's him.
All the subtext is there to sort of say this is a strange world that is being left behind by the liberal 60s into the 70s.
And that's why you mustn't hold back. Let it ruin your youth as I nearly did over Eric. It's like a tide. Give in to it, boy. Go with it. It's society's crime, not ours.
I'm not homosexual, Monty.
Yes, you are. Of course you are.
You feel that these things are changing. And watching it again with fresh eyes as an adult and realising this is all in there.
Yeah. And perhaps it's not quite as liberal as we remember.
Yeah. And it's set at a time of change. The idea being that they've had this high watermark, Danny the drug dealer says, that is also in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where Hunter S. Thompson looks down over the from a high vantage point and sees that a tide mark has washed up and is about to wash back and culture is about to go back to where it was.
Yeah.
The greatest decade in the history of mankind is over. And as presuming Ed here has so consistently pointed out, we have failed to paint it black.
This feeling that for a minute there was a possibility that the world would change. And both Danny and Uncle Monty give speeches of great regret that the world is changing.
Yes.
That this is the last time this will be possible. Maybe the last time it will be possible to be this elegantly wasted.
Oh, my boys. My boys, we're at the end of an age. We live in a land of weather forecasts and breakfasts that set in, shat on by Tories, shovelled up by Labour. And here we are, we three, perhaps the last island of beauty in the world.
And I think watching it, as I watched it in the 90s, as you would have done, I felt, oh, I can't go back there. I feel I ache for this period, the last moment of the 60s, the thing that boomers keep insisting was the best time of all history.
Yeah.
And we missed it.
Well, retrospectively, if the end of the 90s feels like the end of the 60s to me. I think there's so much common ground between the 90s and the 60s. My parents certainly were in their 20s in the 60s. So it obviously informed them. My mum went to see Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles. Wow. But it felt like in the 90s that there was a sort of new freedom that wasn't there in the 80s somehow. There were sort of game shows that became sexy and everything was loud and there was live music everywhere you looked and on every TV channel, The Word, things like that.
A restaging of the 60s almost. Attempt to do it again.
Yeah.
Including the sexism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All the good and the bad of the 60s was back.
Yeah.
But also that sense of possibility and of change. And as someone said, you always forget, just pre-Britpop, rave and things were sort of saying opening your mind and sort of altered consciousness. It was very hippie.
Yes.
That feeling when all the road protests were going on, things, oh, it was like sort of proper. It did feel slightly Withnail-y.
Massively. I mean, you walk around Camden in the sort of 1995, everyone looked like Withnail.
Yes.
You know, everyone had a sort of long jacket, trench coat or a box kind of leather jacket and greasy hair and scarves and rollies everywhere.
All right. I walk with you through the park. We can drink it on the way.
Watching the film, I just felt like I was sort of immersed in that world anyway.
What I think it does do, Withnail, is touch that moment that we've all had where we're all broke, all starving, all aspiring, and all knowing that it might not work in our lives, you know. And for one of them it does not, definitely, and for one of them it might.
One of the things that Withnail promises is that even if you are living a terrible, terrible, low quality, low budget, desperate lifestyle, you will be an absolute hero. You are the hero of your situation. And it's got that in common with that kind of charity shop wit of Jarvis Cocker, that you could be in crap clothes, but you'll be the wittiest guy. Very 90s promise that you didn't need to have loads and loads of high fashion clothing. You could just survive or in a sort of grungy existence and be the hero of your own story.
Oh, we don't look the same as you, and we don't do the things you do, but we live around here too. Oh, really.
And that is immensely appealing and very comforting, especially for someone who is self-dramatising.
My dad will pick up the boxes in a week, and he's going to do something about the car.
Absolutely. I drove a Skoda from sort of 1996, and it was one of those old sort of Soviet Skodas where you could light a fire underneath it.
Skoda's new Super Estel puts the man in the street
and his dog
on the road.
And Skoda was literally a joke. It was a school, it was a playground joke.
Jasper Carrey used to do jokes about them and things.
But I wanted one to drive into sort of counterculture, and it was vomit green, and it had the boot was at the front, and the boot would buckle when you drove it. But that's how much I wanted to not care about what anyone thought. I mean, the thing about Withnail is that, yes, the building next door to them is being knocked down. They've got a scuzzy car. They're living off coffee in a bowl. But they seem at ease with it. They're having a fucking good time, it seems.
Yeah, I don't just mention Jarvis Cocker. It feels slightly Common People-y.
Yeah.
That there's a drama and an elegance to the slumming in it. And there's no sense in which they are not desperate. But you know that at any point they could spend some of the booze money on food.
Yeah, exactly.
But it represents perfectly that period where that's the last thing you'd do.
Yeah.
And I remember that. The order you spend money is it goes on booze and drugs first, and then if you've got any left, it goes on dry pasta. It's that perfect student analogue that I think a lot of people come to the film as students because it kind of feels like student living.
Yeah, absolutely. The romance of student living, the poverty tourism.
It's a bit Young Ones.
Yes.
The same appeal of going, exactly. Oh, Mum and Dad have told us to wash up. We've stopped washing up.
There are things in there. There's a tea bag growing.
They've told us to eat properly. We've stopped eating properly.
Apart from a raw potato, it's the only solid to have passed my lips in the last 60 hours.
This is what it feels like to be left on your own, to look after yourself. And the answer is, well, priority is cider first. And also very specific orders of drinks, but no food.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's when Monty comes into the picture that we start thinking about food. But up until then, it's a raw potato and a pork pie. So I think it's definitely poverty tourism.
It was the most depressing period of my life.
You'd stay in the Spread Eagle till about 3, and then you'd come back and have a couple of bottles of wine, and then you'd start again.
A lot of drinking was done. A lot of drug taking was done.
And then I came back one day, and then I wrote it in the introduction to the first script of Withnail, and I literally wept on the boards, and I just found it amusing, made me laugh. The predicament of a thespian in crisis.
But also this idea that I'm quite happy with this lifestyle. This lifestyle is sort of fueling some sort of inspiration.
Yeah. Affecting a bohemian lifestyle.
Well, it's the end of the party, isn't it? The film begins at the end of the party.
The party is the 60s. This is the end of the mess.
Not just the party, not just the end of the decade, but the end of the bender.
Yeah, they're coming round with that hangover and that enormous glamour that you feel when you get fascinated by that. Around that age, you start to read about like Keith Moon and those great hangover crazies of the 60s going, oh, I want to be like them, without realising they'd be awful to be around these people.
It was only since I was sort of 35 that I thought, actually, do you know what? I fucking hate to hang out with Keith Moon.
Yeah, awful.
Imagine that.
And then he said, yeah, give me your hand with this television set. So I got over and I got one end of the television, the ladies were over that side, and he went over to the window and he threw it out of the window.
The fantasy of like, I know Vivian Stanchel and Graham Chapman, all these sort of alcoholics, you feel, oh, they're the real rebel.
Went boom! And the porter ran out to the hotel. And he looked up and said, what are you doing? And Mooney says, answer the phone. He says, the radio's coming next.
It was terrible to have to write with Graham Chapman. Unbearable job. No wonder John Cleese is like he is. He had that pressure on it. Yeah, the romance of the wasted person, the elegantly wasted person. And yeah, the idea, this is
Harry Nilsson, though.
So go down there and I introduce John as Brandy Alexander. Next thing you know, there's burly characters throwing us in the alley, you know.
I'm a big Nilsson fan, but as the more I read about it, the more I go, yeah, it's quite a selfish man.
The older you get,
the less romantic it feels. But this is a film that really taps into that feeling of that party looks sensational.
It's a film that when you first watch, you're sort of looking up at these characters. They're sort of like your older brother's mates.
Yeah.
When you get to our age, you don't start looking down, but you start to empathise with their psychological trappings.
I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth.
You forget that they would. This is they're very young. This is their first film.
Bruce had never directed before. Paul had done TV, but I don't know that he had actually made a feature film. And I had certainly never done. I'd done one small TV part before that.
To the extent that Uncle Monty, I looked up, he's 39. Richard Griffiths really? Is not even 40.
Wow.
So these are people who are exactly that generation that were finding that the whole world was arranged for them, the young in the 60s. And they're just about to go into the 70s, and the 70s and the 80s are going to be nowhere near as much fun to be young in.
You say that the rot started in the 60s.
The kind of impact that the permissive society, almost permissive ideas, which were then pouring out.
People must seek work, and I believe they are.
Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay.
We will never abandon our belief in God.
And they're at the end of that, and they've seen this opportunity to be wasted and crazy and profligate and waste their talents and waste everything, but so sure that their talent is enough to make them spectacular. It's not insignificant that my very favourite moment of it when I was a kid was him on the top of the mountain shouting, "I'm going to be a star. You'll all suffer." And that's exactly what it feels like at college, where you go, what if I came out and I was spectacular? And you don't know what you're going to be.
No.
And maybe that's the agony of Withnail, is they're about to find out who they're going to be.
Yeah.
And the hidden pain is that Withnail, who's based on Vivian McCarroll, who's Bruce Robinson's old flatmate, is going to die. I really feel Withnail's not going to make it. I do worry that the greatest performance he will ever give is to those wolves at the end. And wow. I think there's a tragedy to it. That born out of the fact that you know the guy he was based on didn't make it. That I think Bruce Robinson, even if you don't read that yourself, there's a feeling of it in there somewhere. That this might be, the greatest two performances he gives might be on the top of that hilltop.
Yeah.
And when he does Hamlet.
To quite literally a captive audience.
Yes.
What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason. How infinite in faculties. How like an angel in apprehension. How like a god. The beauty of the world. Pagan of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
I've never thought of it like that. I've never thought that here's someone on a clear downward spiral. And it seems so obvious now. I always hoped that this would be the U-turn for him.
Yeah, maybe that's...
And that he would either go back to his mum and dad or, you know, but he's 30. So that's something you have to consider. In the 60s, a time when that was already an old dad.
Yeah, yeah.
If he did want to do that, you know. So...
Yeah, he's chosen to trap himself in a profession that if he hasn't made a name for himself by now, he might not.
Yeah. Man delights not me. No, nor women neither. No women, neither.
Maybe the sense of hope in this film comes from the fact that Withnail's greatest performance is being Withnail. His existence, his performance for the ladies in the Penrith tea rooms.
Balls. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now.
This swaggering Richard E. Grant performance, that's Withnail's starring role. His starring role is in his own life, which you get the feeling is Bruce Robinson's relationship to Vivian McCarroll, a man who would never amount to much as an actor, but made a huge impression on his friend to say, this guy was witty and sensational and fast and hilarious.
You had any training in the martial arts?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have. Before I became a journalist, I was in the territorials.
Do you know, when you first came in, I knew you were a services man.
You're watching him give the greatest performance of his career, and it's being alive.
Yes, it's true. He's still the clown, the school clown, which sort of takes me to the music, actually, because I think the music's so beautifully set up. It's so beautifully skewed. What I love about the music, the original music, obviously I love the soundtrack anyway, you know, Hendrix and King Curtis and the rest. But the original music is mostly a melancholic guitar motif.
Yeah.
But it's caked in a circusy pipe organ facade.
Mm. Yeah, it's all dressed up in... It's in a big tent.
Yeah, exactly. It's the melancholic clown underneath the makeup.
towards the end, especially the final moment where Widnall gives his speech to the wolves and then walks into the rain in Regent's Park and disappears off, and the music comes up underneath it, and it is the waltz of a tragic clown.
Yeah.
A performer who all he wants to do is perform for an audience, and no one will listen to him. And all the way through, he's been performing for the clouds, or for one person on a hill, or for those women in the tea room. But no one will ask him to perform for money, and no one will ask him to perform and be the centre stage. And at the end, as he walks off, the music comes up and you realise that he is just a sad clown.
Yeah. I find the circus music attached to that sad motif when he's walking away from the wolf pen. I find the music there, the themes, actually quite grotesque. And it sort of creeped me out a little bit when I first saw it.
Yeah.
Just because it sort of insists on itself. It insists that everything's fine when deep down he's depressed to the point of dangerously harming himself.
Yeah, and we've had that echo. There comes a point in a young man's life
when one morning he awakes and quite reasonably says to himself, I will never play the Dane.
Uncle Monty says, at that point his ambition ceases.
It's part I intend to play, Uncle.
And you'll be marvellous.
And then Widnall takes the one chance he gets to play the Dane and does it to no one, not even humans, just animals.
Yeah.
Pagan of animals!
And then walks away, and this music comes up and says, pity this man.
Yes,
it insists on your reaction, which is this is a grotesque dance he's doing.
Yeah.
This whole hour and 40 minutes has been him performing to people who don't care.
Yes.
No one's listening to him. It's the unlistened to. That's the tragedy of it.
Maybe the clock stopped ticking. Maybe this is the checkpoint, the moment where, you know, I'm not going to be Hamlet, I'm going to be Polonius.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The tragedy of all actors, do you get your one big chance or do you not? And it is nothing to do with talent, it's to do with luck. It's not in your control. This is a desperate job, and one in which very often the situation with Uncle Monty is the only way of getting through, that as Bruce Robinson found, that sometimes you'll be abused by powerful men or find yourself very vulnerable and exposed and taken advantage of. They're acting it out.
Yes.
And yet you're laughing all the way through at these desperate clowns.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting how, even with now, the idea of financial freedom comes into play. He never mentions the cigar commercial to him.
Yeah.
You know, it's not highbrow enough.
Yeah.
So the thing that he's desperate to find out about, the thing that's actually sort of driving his anger at in the first act is the idea that he hasn't heard back from a cigar commercial audition.
Much more of this, I'm going to apply for Meals on Wheels.
What happened to your cigar commercial?
That's what I want to know. What happened to my cigar commercial?
The promise of the 60s was we'd all be able to express ourselves and all be able to be artists.
We hope to make a thing that's free, where people can just come and do and record and not have to ask, could we have another microphone in the studio, because we haven't had a hit yet. If you
want it. I was thinking, watching it this time around, first time I'd watched it since watching Get Back, the Beatles documentary.
Right.
You know the guy who yells, get in the back of the van?
Yeah.
Get in the back of the van!
He is representing the same forces of behave yourselves, hippies, as the policemen in Get Back.
I'm afraid, honestly, it's got to go down, otherwise we'll be arrested. No, I'm not threatening you, I'm telling you what's going to happen.
When the Beatles are playing on the roof and going, hey, it's the 60s, we can express ourselves, the answer is, no, you can't.
Well, we speak of opera, to turn the sound around so they can hear themselves playing, you know.
Well,
yeah.
Can you turn it off, please?
Yeah, OK. Turn the
PA off. It's true.
Will you get back in your box? What Danny the drug dealer represents and what Withnail and Marwood represent is the world of the Beatles, of Apple.
Yes.
Of, we'll give you money to do anything. Self-expression is everything. Hey, the hippies, it's all going to work.
They did run the one ad with the picture of the one-man band saying, send us your tapes and things, and we got billions of them. The tragic thing is, of course, we never found anything through that route that was any good. Quite apart from all the other ideas, people who wanted money to levitate or something totally bizarre.
And then what the other forces of, whether it's the police, who are saying, behave, you can't go and get drunk and drive up the M1.
Are you refusing to fill this bag?
I most certainly am.
Or whether it's Uncle Monty, the forces of the past, are saying, we're about to reassert control. And when Danny says they're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths, it's all over. Stop insisting that the world's going to change.
They're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths, man.
And I think that's the sadness in the theme of Withnail, is that these people were told, this decade, as long as you're talented and ambitious, you'll do fine. And they don't get it.
For Christ's sake, Withnail, stop laughing. This is an obvious ambition. Will you stop laughing? They want to throw us out.
Maybe the rocket was always made of papier-mâché, and it was all just dressing up. Yeah. This idea of rock and roll, of Merseybeat, of psychedelica, of a revolution, these kind of themes that were passed through the decade of the 60s, maybe it was all just dressing up. I remember having conversations with my dad about the 60s, and he saw some incredible acts and amazing artists, but he said it was pretty shit, actually. The food was crap. Everyone was smoking. There was no deodorant. You know, you walked into a pub and it just stunk. It's just like the little things that are every day, what he remembers about the 60s. He said it was not quite as romantic as most people like to remember.
There's a great story about George Harrison going out to Haight-Ashbury, the sort of San Francisco, the hippie dream, to go and see how the hippie model of society would work. And he came back and said,
you know, I went to Haight-Ashbury expecting it to be this brilliant place, and it was just full of horrible, spotty, dropout kids on drugs.
Yeah. With lazy people laying around and not washing. And you must remember, this is a handmade film, so George Harrison is involved in the making of it. This is him saying, this is what it felt like a bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that Summer of Love, a lot of that was bullshit, really.
Maybe it was just a big fancy dress party.
Yeah.
With really, really good music and drugs.
I'm making time.
They're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths. Maybe they were always selling hippie wigs in Woolworths. Maybe I'm sure before then they were probably selling Beatles wigs in Woolworths.
Of course they were. Yeah.
And aping every single thing and exploiting every single sort of fashion movement throughout that entire decade.
Now, you'll like these. You'll really dig them. They're fab and all the other pimply hyperboles. I wouldn't be seeing dead in them. The dead grotty.
Grotty?
Yeah, grotesque. Make a note of that word and give it to Susan.
I feel that Withnail and his desperation with the cigar commercial is offering us a window into perhaps the realities of the 60s.
Love. Everybody needs it. Love with pop cards.
London is a country coming down from its trip. We are 91 days from the end of this decade, and there's going to be a lot of refugees.
Yeah! Prophets in it. The two people who give the big speeches, which is Danny and Uncle Monty, they're both views of changing times.
The old order changeth, yielding place to new. And God fulfills himself in many ways. And soon, I suppose, I shall be swept away by some vulgar little tumour.
And Danny's one is this huge regret that we have, as presuming he had said, we failed to paint it black. We had this big chance and we blew it. And the answer was because it was never really there for us. Why is it so comforting? Is it just that it's lovely to see that someone else has been there too when you're feeling a little bit blue and depressed to go, even the 60s were rubbish.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's the very human desire to decompress. I think that it's something that we all have.
Where exactly have you two been?
Holiday in the countryside.
That's a very good idea.
What I love about the film, what I find so comforting about the film, is obviously the way it looks and everything else, but it's just the very linear story. You never leave the protagonist. Yeah. You're there the whole time. And it almost feels like it's in real time. When the second act begins and they embark on the journey up to Cumbria, you feel like it could be almost Nuts in May, which is another big comfort film of mine, because it's quite slow. There are a lot of scenes in the film that are essentially very small plot points dressed up as big set pieces.
Yeah.
So, for example, the scene where Monty drives them into town and gives them this sort of two blue notes. Is that a fiver or is it a tenner or a 20?
Pair of blues.
Pair of blues, yeah. Two fivers.
Pair of blues.
And they go off to the pub and get rat arse and then go into the cake shop, and you've got this sort of iconic scene in a tea shop.
Miss Blenner has it. Telephone the police.
Really, that plot point is so that he, I guess, so that Marwood can phone home and check in with his agent about Journey's End.
Hasn't heard a thing. Apparently they're still seeing people.
It's very minimal.
Very minimal. There's not really any plot point there at all.
The story is tiny and very, very simple. And basically, it's a move up and a move back. They go on a journey. They go somewhere new. If you listen to Bruce Robinson talking about the edit, he said they kept saying, can we lose this bit? Can we lose that bit? And he went, can we lose Danny the drug dealer? Well, if you lose Danny the drug dealer, you might as well lose Uncle Monty. Because no one is a supporting pillar of the plot. They weren't going to give the money for the making time drive back to London. And he said, well, if you're not going to show the drive back, then don't show the drive up.
Here comes another fucker.
And he had to fund it out of his own wallet, £30,000 of his own money, to film the Voodoo Child return drive.
Oh, no!
Closing part of the M1, I would imagine.
Any scene is removable.
Yeah.
But that also means that every scene is essential. And the other lovely thing about it, for a meandering, plotless film, it keeps your interest. It is edited really tightly. It is not a boring or slow film, even though nothing happens.
Yeah.
Someone has gone through and made a lot of very wise decisions, which again, I think is why it's a great cult comfort film, is that the next thing that's coming along is going to be as great as the thing you're watching now. You don't want to lose any scene. So I imagine as an edit, it was quite a hard thing to do because you could cut everything.
You could, absolutely.
Do you think you could tell me where I could buy some coal and wood?
He runs this farm.
Where is your son?
Up in Topfield. You can't miss him. His legs bound in polythene.
What I love about the second act is we've already established that they can't survive in their own environment. Yes. How are they going to make it work in the Lake District? And the answer is trying to shoot salmon from a river, or using plastic bags for boots, completely unprepared.
They can't kill the chicken.
Yeah.
How do you make it die?
It almost feels like you're with them on a weekend away. When they go for walks, you go for walks.
Yeah, yeah.
When they go to the Crow and Crown.
Brilliant name for a pub. Such a you don't see the sign, but it would be so funny.
The Crow and Crown. It's nicotine-stained, looks like the inside of a lung. That's how it's described. And I would love nothing more than to have a pint in there.
Yeah.
Or just hunker down for the evening, like they do. I just feel like I'm away with them the whole time.
We'll have another pair of large scotches.
And you're enjoying watching them. You're right about its slight Nuts in May quality. It does feel like a really, really good, high-quality TV play.
Yes.
But filmed with all the lovely richness of those great handmade films that look great, like The Missionary and things. It's filmed beautifully. And filmed like a drama, not like a comedy. It's not brightly lit. It's not overacted, though the acting style is huge. It's very real and very grounded and not joke heavy, but dialogue and line heavy. It feels like a lovely thing to watch. And part of the enjoyment is that you're not as cold as they are. And you're not as hungry as they are. So you're observing them.
Yeah.
We've gone on holiday by mistake. We're in this cottage here. Are you the farmer?
Stop saying that, Whitnell. Of course he's a fucking farmer.
And you mentioned earlier on about survival. And this is something that occurred to me watching it this time. It never occurred to me before. There are no women in it, apart from Mrs. Blenner Hassett.
Yeah.
It's a very male cast.
Yes.
But they are constantly threatened by men.
Look at him. Look at Jeff Woad. His head must weigh £50 on its own.
By masculinity, by rage and anger.
Get in the back of the
Donovan!
And competence.
I can bring you some logs up later, but I've got the cows on that to feed first.
Like the poacher.
You want working on, boy.
By violence.
I'll murder the Perius!
They are feminised men because they are ponces.
Ponce!
They're actors. And it's a film in which every man in it who you're following is very unmasculine.
I have a heart condition. If you hit me, it's murder.
They can't use the gun properly. They're really not prepared for survival.
There's a man on the mountain. Why he's up there, fuck knows.
They're constantly threatened, even to the extent they're threatened by a randy bull.
Show no fear. Just run at it.
Well, that can't be sensible. Kind of the bastard's about to run at me.
Well, it's randy.
Yes, yeah, I know he is.
Wants to get down there and have sex with those cows.
Shut up.
They are not people who can survive male aggression.
Yeah.
Imagine the size of his balls. Imagine getting into a fight with a fucker.
And they are not suited to survive.
Maybe it's the farmer.
At 2 o'clock in the morning. It's the killer. He's come to kill us. What are we going to do?
And it hadn't occurred to me that it's incredibly comforting and enjoyable to watch deeply unmasculine men.
We have to tackle him. You stay in bed, pretend to be asleep. He'll go for you. When he does, I'll jump on his back. No. It'll be too late. I'll be knifed by then.
Yeah. If... I'm just saying this, throwing this out there. If you are a deeply unmasculine man, these are my people.
We mean no harm.
They can't throw and they can't catch. And I bloody love that about them, that they are as crap as I would be in the same situation. And it's very funny to watch.
Yes, absolutely. Having to cope with that sort of atypical alphaism.
If I hear more words out of you, I'll put one of these here black pods on you.
Don't threaten me with a dead fish.
What's interesting is, I think, is that, you know, they're in the comfort of their own flat, I say the comfort of their own flat, in the squalor the of their own flat, they are happy to perform for each other.
Yeah.
And certainly after they're caught out in the pub and they're threatened in the pub by the burly Irish dude.
What's your name, Matt? Fuck!
They try and perform their way out of that.
I have a heart condition.
And then... From that point, every sort of stranger they meet, the landlord in the Crow and Crown, yeah, the punters in the tea shop, they make up a phony existence. So he, yeah, Withnell says, oh, I was served in the army, I was in the forces.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily think it's just to get a free drink. I think it's just to play someone else.
We are multi-millionaires. We shall buy this place and fire you immediately. Yes, we'll buy this place and we'll install a fucking jukebox in here. Life and all you stiffs up a bit.
They're constantly insisting they're not who they are.
Listen, we're bona fide, we're not from London.
But they know it's unacceptable.
Yes.
And actually, I'm wondering if this is one of the reasons it appeals to students. Because one of the things that happens as a student, you go away from your home and you're safe in your college or your drama school or your art school or whatever, university. But you have to go into the town. Mm. And in the town, everyone hates you. So very often you keep your voice down. You don't try and attract attention. The worst, most hated students, the student grant type students, are the ones who draw attention. And there's always the risk that someone's going to lamp you.
Absolutely.
And Withnell really sums up that experience of, when I've had a couple of drinks, I might be flamboyantly attracting attention. And it's a real student feeling that you're kind of unwelcome,
yeah,
in the real world.
Yeah, it's true.
It depicts that brilliantly.
My drama school has moved from where it used to be. It's moved down to Peckham now. And there is a distinct lack of students being loud in Wood Green High Street and sort of jetting down the street and doing pliés in the pub and sort of singing their drink order. Because that's like absolutely what it was like. It was like sort of fame was happening in North London. And I genuinely miss it. But there was safety in numbers. You were sort of safe with yourself and you could coexist in the outside world as long as there was more than one of you.
We're in danger. We've got to get out.
What are you talking about?
I've been called a ponce.
What fucker said that?
They have each other. They can look after each other. They can. There's a defence in there. But the way that Marwood is very hypersensitive to how loud Withnell is.
Little tarts, they love it.
Listen, I'm trying to drive this thing as quietly as possible. If you don't shut up, I'll get stopped by the police.
There's a feeling that this kind of behaviour, this very... almost Julian and Sandy noisiness, which was supposed to be permitted by the 60s. You could be flamboyant and big, has a cost. The society won't let them do it. And they're always up against these very frighteningly competent men who are their enemy. And then also they're threatened by an incredibly effeminate man.
You are a toilet trader.
Yes.
Who is also a threat to them.
Because the 60s didn't exist, Joel. It's all a joke.
Yeah. It's very odd the way that they're depicted that way. And that was a huge risk. I know stories from many people that certainly being an actor in the 60s, there was a threat of a sort of, that you were expecting, you're a chorus line boy, to be available.
Yeah.
To sort of aggressive interest from impresarios and rich men who would just take their pick.
Mm.
That was definitely a part of, and also Bruce Robinson suffered that with Zeffirelli, didn't he?
Yeah, which is mentioned in the beginning of the film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Romeo and Juliet in the newspaper.
Oh, look at this little bastard. Oh, he lands Plumrow for top Italian director. Of course he does. Probably on a tenner a day, and I know what for. £2.10 a tip and a fiver for his arse.
A fiver for his arse.
Yeah, that feeling. Yeah. He'd been through that, and the idea being that you were supposed to be available and vulnerable. These are vulnerable, sensitive young men who are very talented, and the 60s said, you can go out and be yourselves. And they're finding they sort of can't.
Yeah.
Because they're then going to be picked on.
Yeah, totally.
Listen, we can't stay. You won't leave me alone. All right, we'll get the lunch down and then we'll leave.
The idea of them being vulnerable is very interesting, especially that scene with the bull.
Yes.
Which apparently, again, Dennis O'Brien said, cut that out. And Bruce Robinson was saying, I want the scene with the bull. I want the scene with the bull. I want a randy bull. The countryside, masculinity, sexuality to threaten them. This thing wants sex with them. And they're going to run away. It's basically Uncle Monty again.
Yes.
They're constantly in a state of things are hammering at gates and windows to get in and get them.
He's sharpening them. Knife.
Kind of a horror film in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
First time I watched it, I thought that's where it was going. It was going to be one of those sort of survival horror things.
But so you thought the poacher was actually like a kind of...
It might have gone
that slasher.
Way. Yeah, I don't know. It looks a bit like a horror film.
Yeah.
Don't be a fool, he's got a gun. Bastard psychotic, you've only got to look at him.
There's an astonishing interview with Bruce Robinson from about 99 where he talks about his fear of animals.
And I like the bull. I have a real fear of... of bulls. I have a fear of animals.
You know, I was really frightened of that bull, and I wanted the bull to be in it because it was about fear of something coming and getting.
I used to have this recurring dream. You're obviously going to cut this, but anyway, I used to have this dream that there would be a rhinoceros trying to get in the window.
And he says in his memoirs that he was abused by his stepfather.
Right.
There's this very pretty, clever, witty, funny, young, delicate performer under threat by these very forceful animal urges.
I'll see this fucking rhino. It was white and all gooey like a huge fetus with its sort of white horn wobbling around.
He's expressed through this drama, and the two perfume ponces are threatened constantly by very aggressive men.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether he even knows that's the story he's written. But it does help you feel for them. And I think it is one of the secret stories of Widnall, is about two delicate men. You said it's a survival story.
Yes.
How will they survive? The threat appears to be that energy.
Very interesting.
A coward you are, Withnell! An expert on bulls you are not!
Fighting a bull with Jacob's cream crackers.
I love it. You can see the groceries.
It's an allegory for that, or could be.
He's been shopping.
He must know. Surely, I don't think it would be subconscious, that decision, would it?
And one of the reasons it is such a wonderful film is the more you watch it, the more you notice the small things, and all the small things are considered.
Yeah,
and they're the right decisions.
Now, garlic, rosemary, and salt. I can never touch meat until it's cooked. As a youth, I used to weep in butcher shops.
Garlic, rosemary, and salt. I still use that to this day. Whenever there's a leg of lamb, every spring.
Would it be in bad form to plagiarise a toast? Depends entirely on the quality of the wine. In this instance, most certainly would not. In that case, it's a delightful weekend in the country. Oh, splendid.
When Monty turns up, the look of the film completely changes.
It does.
It becomes a light film. The cottage looks like it's had a makeover.
Yeah.
And he's only just arrived in the dead of night. There's bacon on the grill. You can hear a fry up cooking, breakfast in 10 minutes. All of a sudden, it's a functioning world.
A grown-up's turned up and someone's looking after him.
Exactly, yeah.
He's going to revitalise himself and you're going to finish the vegetables.
I don't know how to do them.
Well, of course you don't. You are incapable of indulging in anything but pleasure, am I not right?
They can indulge themselves because there's a minder there. It reminds me of when I used to go home at the weekend when I was a student and really enjoy my mum's cooking, whereas before perhaps I didn't quite so much. And if she said, oh, it's cottage pie tonight, I'd be like, oh, God. But I used to love it. And we'd have a bottle of red wine, whereas I'd been drinking sort of aftershock in the week. And it just, as you say, you as an audience feel so safe when Monty turns up.
Yeah, because he keeps a sensational cellar.
A sensational cellar.
The moment you go, they're going to, their quality of life goes up, and he brings safety. And then you realise that that's come at the cost of Withnell betraying his friend, because he will do anything to keep that comforting blanket around himself of privilege. And it comes with Monty.
Yes, absolutely.
If you think you're going to have a weekend's indulgence up here at his expense, which means him having a weekend's indulgence up here at my expense, you've got another thing coming.
Withnell uses Monty. I mean, Withnell uses everyone.
I give you my word, we'll leave first thing tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow? What about tonight?
He's not going to try anything.
Of course he is. What do you think he's up here? He means business.
That's another thing as well. I think it sort of it sets the perimeters. You know, you feel like Withnell eventually learns what the perimeters are. Like, he believes, I think, that he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Get the house at all costs through whatever means
yes
necessary.
I know what you're thinking, but I had no alternative. The old bugger's come a long way and I didn't want to put the wind up.
They need a holiday, we'll do this. Yeah, that's the bargain.
Absolutely.
And then when Monty turns up, he brings the comfort with him. You suddenly realise this is a nice house that he does bring young men to.
Yeah.
Suddenly the fire is blazing. The food is good. You do really want to be there playing cards with these lovely witty men. And they're sharing banter and lines. And he is accepting of them. He's not the guy from the pub and he's not the farmer. He brings all the luxury of Chelsea, a place where they would be at home.
Yes.
When you're away from home, the idea that someone would turn up and bring home to you with them as a treat. It's a very luxurious scene, the Monty scenes when he comes and cooks for them and things.
I love it. Absolutely love it. I wish I was there. I can taste the meal.
Yeah.
With no proper facilities. All the glorious trials of youth, dear boy. When I was a lad, I'd rocket off on my tandem with Wrigglesworth and we'd just ride and ride.
Around the meal is good conversation and good chat and rich ideas and things. That no one in this film is short of dialogue. No one is short of the right thing to say. Even the guy who's stoned out of his head is funny and witty and eloquent.
What are you going to do with those?
The joint I'm about to roll requires a craftsman. Can utilise up to 12 skins. It is called a Camberwell carrot.
This is a film that the only thing they've got luxuriously is language, and it celebrates that.
Oh, but how dreadful. Do you mean you've been up here in all this beastly mud and umskar without Wellingtons?
It's funny that when they're around the table having dinner and they're just sort of finishing up dinner, and Marwood is desperate to go home because I think he knows what's about to happen. You're not on his side. Yes. You know, the antagonist in that situation is Richard E. Grant, is Withnell, I think. And he very much wants to stay because all of a sudden he's been presented with a beautiful roast lamb and a high quality bottle of red. He wants to stay and you want them to stay.
Yes.
You want this to happen and you kind of know what's going to happen.
Yeah, you don't want him to go back and get the job.
Yeah.
You want him to stay.
And the thing is,
Withnell.
And it's horrendous because you've already seen the scene where Monty helps him look for the herbs in his grocery bags, and he's essentially assaulting him at that point.
Yeah, it's not nice.
So you know what's coming.
Sure, we could find it together.
But you don't care because you want to stay and watch them eat roast dinners.
Yeah, the joy of watching them talk and make you laugh, the comedy of it is so cleverly balanced. I know Bruce Robinson said, I hate jokes.
Handmade were very much into sort of joke type of movies. At its very best, Life of Brian, fantastic, you know, but it isn't my kind of thing.
Didn't want comedy lighting, didn't want comedy lines. I wanted truth and character, which, of course, as you know, as a writer and performer, truth and character is really funny.
Yes, absolutely.
You don't need... Jokes sometimes belong to nobody. Good lines always belong to characters.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's good to have a sort of joke mechanics in there somewhere, and I think we certainly do with Ghosts and things like that. But absolutely. I mean, it's still, I think it's probably the most quotable film, certainly in my friendship groups.
Yeah.
You know, but also, you know, it needs to be a good film. A film can be a quotable film, but also it has to be a good film first, yeah. I think. certainly well liked. Otherwise, what's the point of quoting to someone who doesn't know it? But you know, I mean, but there, I mean, there's Police Academy. That's quite quotable as well.
Do you think she's a better or worse film than
Police Academy? If I compare the two, I think it's a better film than Police Academy.
I'm sure.
I think so.
I'm sure the BFI would agree with you. Yeah.
Perfumes of nature sighing on our skin.
What's lovely is it's a film that came out and found an audience, and it found an audience that then used it as a unit of exchange, saying that we like this. You look at the other films that Handmaid were making around the time, this film's like Water.
I always feel as if I'm wearing a live chicken on my head.
Water is a film that no one should be forced to sit through, which should be a really good comedy film. It's pedigree, it's written by good people, it's got good people in it, and yet no one would sit through that. Yeah. And that on paper is a load of jokes and a farce, but it's unwatchable. Whereas With Nell on Paper maybe has no jokes in it. Maybe you can't even see those jokes until you're with an audience and you realise you're all laughing together.
Yes.
Until you saw it finished and you saw its texture and its depth. It's really strange for a film that is so beautifully written that you suspect it might not work on paper.
So we put the film up and they start laughing. Not immediately, about 10 minutes in. And they start sort of that sense of, oh, this is a funny film, you know. Is it funny? Yeah, but now they're laughing. And there were two girls in front of me. By about 35 minutes in, they were standing up to laugh, hanging over their seat in front of them. I thought they were going to choke.
The casting of this and the direction of it and the way it's made and its confidence of tone is what you're laughing at.
Yes.
Maybe on paper it would look like it was a bit self-indulgent. I don't know.
I mean, it's an interesting point. The only people I know who like it or certainly have seen it are other artists, other writers, actors, performers. Everyone I know, my friends sort of back home who I grew up with, I grew up watching Ghostbusters with and Predator and Robocop and, you know, those films. I don't think they would choose to watch With Nail and I. They would watch it and enjoy it. But I don't think they'd choose to watch it. I certainly don't think it would be in their top 10. I'm not saying that fridge engineers and plumbers can't enjoy a film about actors, but I think that it resonates with artists.
It belongs to you. It's like a representation thing.
Yeah.
These are our guys. What you're saying is that, and this is a bold claim, which I will hold you to, that this is Peter's Friends, but good. They've detoxified Peter's Friends.
Yeah.
It's about lovey actors who think they're sensational, but this one is really brilliant.
Accident, black spot. These aren't accidents. They're throwing themselves into the road gladly. Throwing themselves into the road to escape all this hideousness. Throw yourselves into the road, darling. You haven't got a chance.
It's like I was listening to Ingrid's comfort blanket about the Goonies.
Yeah, yeah.
And how when you're watching that as a kid, you aspire to have that sort of adventure. That's a dream situation. And I think if you have sort of aspirations away from being any sort of artist, then this just looks sad, depressing, and sort of a bit destructive. Whereas if you're an artist, maybe it's the romance. That's the goal.
What a wonderful thing. Because that then puts it in a very strange and elite group of films, which I'm now thinking of and thinking of so warmly about. Everyone will have their own version of this. I think this about the film Frank. The Frank Sobleton film is a beautiful film about being an artist. Anvil.
Yeah.
Spinal Tap.
Exactly.
Which is often lumped together with as one of those quotable films. They're all films about the pain and stupidity of trying to make art when you're a bit of an idiot.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what's beautiful about this.
Yeah, it's completely out of your hands. Often you're just sort of, you know, tearing down a white river. But if you're not an artist or that way inclined, I'm not saying this film won't resonate with all non-artists, of course, but I'm saying perhaps you have a greater understanding of the plight of artists when you are one, and that sometimes the plight is a challenge, a gauntlet that you must run in order to get there somehow. I don't know.
That really links in with what we're saying about, say, this is a self-imposed misery.
Yeah.
They have got enough money if they don't try and numb all the pain with booze. They have got enough money if they don't spend it on drugs. The life they've chosen for themselves of poverty and desperation might look like, oh, it's poverty tourism, pure Jarvis Cocker, pure common people. But that is the life very often of people who've chosen to not have a regular secure income in order to do something mad and creative. They found themselves trapped here, but they've trapped themselves in that place themselves.
Yeah.
This was their decision.
Yes.
Maybe that speaks to you.
I think so. I mean, I sort of liken it to the end of The Last Crusade when they each try and sort of find the grail.
Yeah.
And if you're not careful, you're going to get your head chopped off. You're going to fall through a bridge. You're going to, you know, there are many pitfalls in this life, the life that we've chosen. But it's the challenge that keeps us there.
That's wonderful. What a beautiful thing. It is a film about mad, doomed artists that immediately appeals to mad, doomed artists. It's clearly yours. It belongs to you.
Thank you.
I give you with that or not.
Are you out of your mind? Pull over. You haven't got a license.
No, I'm making time.
Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris. The Cheese and Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media and don't forget to like and subscribe.